Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to 1A. Before we dive in, we'd like to know better who's listening to the show and how you're using podcasts. So please help us out by taking a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. It takes less than 10 minutes and it would really help us out. Again, that's npr.org/podcast survey, all one word. Okay, thanks for listening. On to the show. This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. There are things we may never know, reports we might never see, documents that could remain sealed and secured from the public maybe forever. Elements of the Mueller report and the Jussie Smollett case may remain mysteries for at least the foreseeable future. But those stories have still given us plenty to talk about. We'll stick to what we know and try to make sense of what we don't know on today's Friday News Roundup. Joining us this week to help out is Susan Glasser, a staff writer for The New Yorker and a global affairs analyst at CNN. Susan, welcome back to the Roundup.
So glad to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is Aswin Subsang, a White House reporter for The Daily Beast. Swin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Yamiche Alcindor is a White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour and also an NBC News contributor. Yamiche, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the Mueller report. The special counsel wrapped up the Russia probe and gave his findings to the Attorney General, William Barr, over the weekend. This week, the Attorney General submitted a 4-page summary of that report to Congress. According to Barr's letter, Mueller found no proof of conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia. But the conclusion on obstruction of justice is a little murkier. Yamiche, there's been a lot of critique this week on how the press has phrased and reported what was in the report summary. So we'll try to be really surgical with the way we describe it. First of all, to the question of conspiracy with Russia, the president's claims of no collusion, what did the report actually find according to William Barr's summary?
According to William Barr's summary, the report found that there was no evidence that the president colluded with Russia. So he was essentially cleared of this idea that he and his campaign were working with Russia to try to influence the campaign. They did, of course, find in the letter that Russia tried to influence the campaign through both hacking the DNC emails and also through social media. They said that he called it, at least through William Barr, sowing discord in the United States. So it's important to note that a lot of the people that were indicted by Mueller, the majority of the people who were indicted were actually Russian nationals. But essentially, as the president's been saying for the last 2 years, he's been screaming no collusion. And Robert Mueller essentially said, yeah, you're kind of right.
Swin, there's also the obstruction of justice piece of the report. Its finding was mixed. So can you clarify for us a little more precisely how the attorney general characterized Mueller's findings?
Sure, absolutely. Well, in the summary, the brief summary those issued of the reportedly 300-page plus Mueller report that the American public has not seen a redacted or unredacted version of yet, Trump's Attorney General William Barr characterized it as it was inconclusive, that Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his team did not arrive at a, strictly speaking, a determination of whether or not the President of the United States did or did not obstruct justice. Now, shortly after the report was officially filed to the DOJ, and then not too long after that, when Barr put out his statement and his brief summary, there was a determination by him and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein saying that, no, next, President Trump did not obstruct justice, or at the very least, it does not clear the very high legal bar set if you are to state that a president actually did obstruct justice. So again, there is a lot we don't know because we haven't seen the report, because it does seem to be a clear suggestion that within the report there is a set of evidence or suggestions that, yes, the president could have very well obstructed justice. And then on the other side, well, here's the potentially but not quite exonerating counter-evidence.
Now, the House Judiciary Committee Chair Gerald Nadler has given the Attorney General, William Barr, a deadline of April 2nd, next Tuesday, to give Congress the full report. He spoke about his conversation with the Attorney General on CNN. Here's part of what he said.
I'm most concerned that when I asked whether he could commit
that the American people and the Congress would see the entire unredacted report and the underlying evidence, he would not make a commitment on that. And that is not acceptable.
That was Congressman Gerald Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, speaking this week. Susan Glasser, what does all of this mean for whether or not the public will see the report in part or in full?
Well, look, first of all, I believe ultimately it is likely that we will see the report. The historical record suggests one way or the other. Whether that's going to be next Tuesday or not is highly a different matter. And in fact, I think most of us would expect at this point that we're not going to be seeing a truck drive up to the Capitol with the full report there, and that it's going to be released a few hours later, which, by the way, is exactly what happened with the Ken Starr report during the Clinton impeachment saga. We are looking at a very different situation here, and I it looks to me as though we're headed towards a real conflict between the executive branch and Congress, the Democratic House of Representatives, over just what will be released and when and how. And in that sense, the Trump administration has had a very successful, from their point of view, rollout of this, where they've tightly controlled the information, presented it in the most favorable light to the president. You know, unfortunately, I think that really undermines, in a way, though, the purpose of the investigation, if it is to give the confidence of the American people in the conclusions of this 22-month inquiry by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Essentially, we're being asked not only just to take his word for it, but to take his word as filtered through a political appointee of the president. And remember, all this analysis that we're doing right now is essentially on the basis of two partial sentences that are directly from the Mueller report that are included in the Barr letter of Sunday. So I don't think that's going to stand as the full record of what we get, and that's public ultimately. But it really, it speaks of a highly politicized, but also in a sense a botched rollout, because we're left questioning, what are we even talking about here? We look at this difficulty that we've had characterizing what exactly is in the Barr thing.
Right.
These are legal interpretations, but remember, the president is not subject to a criminal case of obstruction of justice or of conspiracy under the Department of Justice guidelines. So does this legal analysis matter? Isn't it really the evidence and the facts that are in the report that would matter from the point of view of Congress, which is the only constitutionally appointed entity that is supposed to hold the president accountable?
To the point of that, one of our listeners, Red Rover, tweeted, "My prediction is that Barr will try to whitewash the entire case for obstruction as laid out by Mueller. They will redact so much that it'll be dripping of toner. This close to the election, there will be no good time to release this data, but the American people paid $50 million for the Mueller report, and we have a right to see it unredacted and complete. We paid for that thing, and we want to see it. End of story. Caput, fini, terminado." Swin, that's not correct, is it? I mean, we don't have the right to see certain aspects of the data in the report under certain circumstances. Like, there are legitimate legal grounds on which William Barr could, or anyone, could redact pieces of that report that would have nothing to do with politics.
Oh, sure. But in one form or another, as Susan pointed out earlier, I think it's highly unlikely that, again, in one form or another, not exactly sure what form that will take, the American people will see some sort of version of this reportedly 300-page-plus report. And one of the people who knows just as well as anybody else that this isn't over is actually the president of the United States himself, in actually multifaceted ways. As we reported the Daily Beast earlier, starting late last year, President Trump had multiple conversations with his outside legal team, which includes, of course, figures such as Jay Sekulow and Rudy Giuliani. And they've been handling a lot of the pushback to the Russia probe and the Mueller investigation. He had multiple conversations with them starting late last year that he wanted them to stay on even once the Mueller report was officially filed and transmitted to the Department of Justice. Because even for all of his bravado and swagger, President Trump is aware that this isn't going away. The report hasn't been made public yet, so there might be some public relations or legal pushback necessary for that. At the front of his mind when he was talking to Sekulow and Giuliani privately in the White House and outside of it was the investigations in SDNY in the New York Southern District. So
federal prosecutors in Manhattan.
Exactly. So there is a lot that is going to plague not just President Trump, but Trump world at large, his business empire, his inner circle, his political associates, that has to do with federal and Capitol Hill investigations and also lawsuits that, you know, President Trump's legal bills are going to be looking pretty hefty for quite some time. And he knows that.
I do want to get a deeper sense, Yamiche, of where the president goes with this in just a moment. But I do get that several of you listening in are really very intent on hearing the entire report, particularly based on some of the reporting on the report. James wrote on our Facebook page, honestly, the report has to be released before news outlets can pretend to know what's in it. Katie agrees. Katie writes, we don't know what's in the Mueller report. We don't know what's in the Mueller report. And by the way, we don't know what's in the Mueller report. Let's talk a little bit more, Yamiche, about the president's response to all of this. A number of Republicans have responded to the end of the probe, most notably the president. He held a rally last night in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Here's part of what he said then.
The collusion delusion is over. The special counsel completed its report and found no collusion and no obstruction. I could have told you that 2.5 years ago very easily.
President speaking last night at a rally in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Yamiche, he went on to say that the probe was done in order to, in his words, illegally regain power by framing innocent Americans. Before we talk about the politics of all this, let's just fact check what the president said. When he said that it found no obstruction, that's not quite correct. But what? Let's fact check the rest of what he said.
Well, what part?
Where to begin?
But I think if you're saying the fact that he said that he's cleared of obstruction, that's obviously not true in the way that William Barr wrote of this report. If he's saying though that we should all take William Barr's word, then he is in some ways in his own mind correct. And this is kind of what everyone in Trump world, I'm thinking of close associates that I was talking to, his personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani and others around him, were telling me even before the Mueller report came out that he was already vindicated. And that's basically the word that people close to President Trump have been using. But I also want to remind people that William Barr was the same man that in June 2018, before he was attorney general, when he was a private citizen, he sent a memo to the DOJ saying that the investigation on obstruction was, quote, fatally misconceived. So before he ever got his hands on this report and before he ever became even attorney general, he already had an idea of what the framing of this was going to be. I also want to point out that James Comey, we remember that I would call it the press conference to end all press conferences, when he came out and said Hillary Clinton is cleared, but she acted recklessly. She was negligent. Robert Mueller could have done the exact same thing with President Trump and say, none of this was criminal. I'm very confused about the fact that the president would be taking meetings with Russian officials, and maybe next time we have an election, candidates, if a Russian official comes out to you and says, I have dirt on your opponent, that's not something you should take, that the president acted recklessly. On obstruction, he could say, as Swin pointed out, there are a lot of issues with the way that the president acted, and we should not have private meetings with your FBI director and ask them to pull back on investigations as the president did with Michael Flynn. So I think that's why seeing the report is so critical, because the president and everyone around him understands that you can be cleared criminally and still have all sorts of issues with your behavior.
I think, though, Susan, with regards to seeing the report, there are folks who are on the president's side on this who would like for this to just be done. Carol emailed, it is over, give it up, move along.
Well, that may well be true, but those are different issues, it seems to me. First of all, there is, if only for the credibility of the Justice Department and of Robert Mueller and those who engaged in this investigation, this is not a sufficient public record for anyone to have confidence in any findings, because A, we don't actually know what they are, and B, it's just not consistent with the very long history of big independent investigations into allegations like this and presidential administrations. We have a long history and tradition of this, unfortunately. You could say whether it's Iran-Contra, Watergate, the Clinton investigation, this will come out in some form. And I believe that it needs to for the historical record and also for the confidence of the American people. Look at how people are still debating the Warren Commission's investigation of President Kennedy's assassination decades later. This is really crucial, and it's all the more so crucial in a country right now that is so divided and in which people are already inclined not to accept facts on their own merit, but only through the filter of partisan prism. And so it's all the more important that we see what this investigation really was, what the conclusions were, number one. Number two, as you can see from this conversation today, we continue to be having a debate over what we're even talking about. When it comes to the President of the United States, it's not clear to me that having a narrow legal discussion about whether or not he should be charged or that the evidence against him has reached some sort of a criminal threshold according to Department of Justice guidelines is even relevant, given that the Department of Justice's own rules suggest that you cannot charge a president. So what's the standard by which you are judging him, which again makes the investigation itself and what the evidence and the facts are. Now, your correspondent makes an important political point, it seems to me. Should we just be moving on? Isn't it just better for the country to say, okay, they've done this investigation. These are horrific allegations. And by the way, I would think whatever your political persuasion is, do you want the President of the United States to be cleared of allegations that he was actively working with a hostile foreign power? Of course you do, whether you're Democrat or Republican. And so, you know, again, the issue is the politics of it, which I do believe have shifted. The threat of impeachment and removal from office by the Mueller investigation, it was always remote. It's now, I think, disappeared as a result of this.
I think also with regards to releasing the report, there are a lot of people who want to know what's in it because there's been so much wordsmithing going on about what every little bit and piece means.
Yes.
Robert tweeted, "Please quit reporting that the Barr letter states that the Mueller report found no evidence of collusion. It doesn't state that anywhere. It is very carefully wordsmithed." Now, the actual quote from the report is that Mueller, quote, "did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities," unquote. I would say we've tried to be very careful with the wording to basically say if there was evidence of collusion, the Mueller probe did not find it, rather than saying there was none. Swin?
Also, collusion is an illegal term.
It's not a crime.
The President of the United States has been very good over these past couple of years in terms of framing. And that goes far beyond the subject of the Mueller investigation. But on this particular topic, just him screaming on Twitter in public statements at rallies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No collusion, no collusion, no collusion. It really has set up the framing of this for whenever the Mueller report would drop, or in this case, the summary of it. He gets to say, okay, they say there's no clear evidence or beyond a reasonable doubt or whatever for conspiracy. Great. No collusion. That means I never picked up the phone and called Vladimir Putin and said, yo, Vlad, let's collude and destroy Hillary Clinton. So
that would have been the best phone call ever if that had been what he said.
Yeah, especially if it had been picked up by intelligence services.
Yeah,
so
Vlad,
weird thing about talking about colluding and collusion, which, as you point out, is not at all a legal term, for the past 2 years or so, is that it's kind of moved the conversation of where I think it should be. Like, too many people have been looking at this, both in the political sphere and outside of it, as a Tom Clancy novel instead of a Coen Brothers movie, which if you've looked at the findings of not just Team Mueller, but reporters over the last couple of years, and the bungling nature in which Russian actors really did try to collude with high-level or reach out to high-level or low-level Trump associates, it really does underscore the dark humor of the whole situation. And it's already a massively important story within the public interest to report that out anyway. You don't need a Jean Le Carre novel brought to life for it to be newsworthy. And I think that's something that Trump has sort of established.
Yamiche, before we move on?
The only thing I would say is the question now still remains, and why I think we'll keep talking about this, is in 2020, if you're a candidate and a Russian official reaches out, is it illegal for you to take that meeting? Is it illegal for the president to be on Air Force One dictating statements in the name of his son, lie about it, and then turn around and say, actually, you got us. It wasn't about the meeting in Trump Towers with this Russian official wasn't about adoption. It was actually about getting dirt on Hillary Clinton. I think that's why people are going to be clamoring to see this report for a long time. I also think that Democrats are in a very very delicate situation in that Nancy Pelosi needs to usher in a Democratic Party that is seen as not just harping on the Mueller report, but also has ideas for the American people. And in 2020, you're going to see, that's why you see people on the campaign trail not talking about this. Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, they're trying to talk about healthcare. They're trying to talk about other things because they realize if they talk about the Mueller report, they're going to look like they're sore losers, even if we don't exactly know what's in the report. And that's the problem with the framing of this.
Susan, briefly.
Well, again, two quick points. Number one, part of the reason I think Swin's point is excellent about collusion, part of the reason that we're talking about it over and over and over again is because Donald Trump, I think very correctly from his point of view, succeeded in framing this as a discussion of no collusion from the beginning. As you know, he tweeted about it over and over and over again. He talked about it over and over and over again. Why? Because he established the standard by which he wanted to be judged so that when it was found that there was no collusion, whatever that means, therefore he would claim complete and sweeping vindication. They're not arguing the fact set here, which is very damaging for them, whether not in a legal sense, but in a political sense, in a moral and ethical sense. Is this the behavior that you want the President of the United States engaging in? And instead of having that national conversation, we are having the national conversation that President Trump orchestrated for us around this.
Claude tweeted, the reason the Trump administration decided to attack the ACA, Obamacare, this week was to divert Democrats' attention from demanding the full Mueller report. Don't take the bait. Stay focused. Polls show between 77% from a CBS poll and 84% from a CNN poll of Americans want to see the full report. Well, we can focus on two things at once. We focused on the Mueller report, but Claude makes an interesting point about the effort to bring down the Affordable Care Act, and that's what we should also talk about this week. There are actually a number of healthcare stories this week. For one, a federal judge blocked Kentucky and Arkansas from imposing work requirements on people receiving Medicaid. And then in a legal filing on Monday, the Justice Department took an even harder stance than it previously had against the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Yamiche Alcindor, this was the very first kind of big marquee plan under the Trump administration, and there were multiple attempts to try to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. How does that effort before compare with what the president says this effort would be now?
It's exactly the same thing. They want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but Republicans and the White House have not articulated what their plan would be. So it's, in some ways, as a reporter, remarkable that the president can be out there. I was on the White House lawn yesterday saying, we will have a plan eventually. When we get to the Supreme Court and we win this lawsuit, trust us, we will come up with something. When the American people are saying, wait a minute, you're going to take away my health care, even Republicans, you're going to take away my health care, but not tell me what I'm going to give, what you're going to give me. And I think that's why you saw the late Senator John McCain give that famous thumbs down, because he said, we cannot take away people's health care and not give them something. So Republicans remarkably are making the same argument that they made before, except that now I think everybody understands that that's even harder to do because the Democrats control the House. So it's, to me, a befuddling that this is the argument that Republicans are making.
Jennifer, with regard to that argument, wrote on our Facebook page, Republicans have had nearly 10 years to come up with something better, and yet they have produced nothing. They seem to have forgotten that the ACA was originally a Republican idea. And Carmen wrote on our Facebook page, what does the DOJ have to do with health care? Swin, that's an interesting question. The fact that the Department of Justice is taking a strong stand on the Affordable Care Act as opposed to, say, the Department of Health and Human Services, that's kind of interesting, too, I think.
Well, it's also triggered critics to criticize Trump's DOJ with certain lines of inquiry and attacks, such as your job is plainly stated to defend the laws of the land, and Obamacare, whether you like it or not, is the law of the land. And you're not only taking the wishy-washy position that you did earlier on the Texas lawsuit, which at some point is expected, I think at some point in 2020, you know, in the heat of Trump's reelection campaign, to weave its way up to the Supreme Court. But earlier, Trump's DOJ had taken the position that, well, we're going to sort of take a passive position at this. We're for a lot of Obamacare falling by the wayside, but stuff like the pre-existing conditions and other popular stuff, yeah, we're for that. Now, they're just going full throttle. Nope, throw the baby out with the entire bathwater, tub, everything. And yeah, we're all for this. We are hoping that the Supreme Court makes, in their view, the right decision, strikes the entire thing down come probably next year.
There's another big policy story that moved this week, and that had to do with the so-called Green New Deal. Debate over that continued this week in Congress, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is a Republican, brought the Democrats' bill to a vote on Tuesday, which led to its defeat. Now, Republicans have been mocking Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the Democrats, but the issue of climate change is being pushed front and center. On Tuesday, Senator McConnell publicly stated that he does believe in human-caused climate change. Susan, what does all this mean for the future of this Green New Deal, before we pause?
Well, look, Senator McConnell sees an advantage potentially for Republicans. He's looking to create a 2020 election issue out of what they see as a sort of overly broad and not ready for primetime series of pledges on the part of Democrats who are supporting the Green New Deal that aren't realistic and that aren't supported by the American people. Democrats actually, even though they support many of them, the Green New Deal, voted present on this rather than being forced into what they saw as a political trap by the Senate Majority Leader. I see it as an early skirmish in 2020. Hope we can get back to healthcare, because I do think that this is potentially one of the more significant internal Republican feuds that President Trump has launched this week.
There's a lot more we got to get to on the roundup, so we got to move on. But there's one more story from Congress this week we wanted to mention regarding President Trump's emergency declaration to build a wall on the southern border. The president already vetoed a bill that sought to block the emergency declaration for that wall. This week, the House failed to override the veto. The vote was 248 to 181. 14 Republicans joined the Democrats, but that's still short of the two-thirds majority needed to override, so now the battle heads to the courts. We will focus on the border on Monday, because Homeland Security and Border Patrol officials say there's just not enough space to house all the migrants who are crossing the border from Mexico. And this week, some migrants were housed behind a chain-link fence under a bridge in El Paso, Texas. We will have the latest on that and debate what could be done on Monday. Oklahoma is making the producers of OxyContin pay for their role in the opioid crisis, quite literally. Purdue Pharma and its owners, the Sackler family, agreed to a settlement with the state of Oklahoma of $270 million. The Sacklers are a very powerful philanthropic family, especially in the art world. One of the Smithsonian's Asian art galleries is named for Arthur Sackler. And this week, the Tate Museums in London and the Guggenheim in New York decided they would no longer accept gifts from the family. Facebook faces a new lawsuit from the Department of Housing and Urban Development for allegedly violating the Fair Housing Act. The suit accuses the social network of, quote, encouraging, enabling, and causing housing discrimination, unquote. Facebook allows advertisers to target their ads to very specific demographics, including real estate ads. HUD says that practice lets companies keep their ads away from certain users based on traits like their race, religion, familial status, or disability. In a statement, Facebook said, quote, "We're surprised by HUD's decision, as we've been working with them to address their concerns and have taken significant steps to prevent ad discrimination," unquote. The charges will be heard by an administrative law judge or in federal court. Let's get to a story outside the Beltway that has had the entire country talking for quite some time, and that has to do with Jussie Smollett, the actor from the Fox series Empire. On Tuesday, prosecutors in Chicago dropped all 16 felony charges against Mr. Smollett. They had accused him of faking his own assault after an alleged incident in January. Smollett spoke briefly following that decision. Here's what he said at the press conference.
"I want you to know that not for a moment was it in vain. I've been truthful and consistent on every single level since day one. I would not be my mother's son if I was capable of one drop of what I've been accused of. This has been an incredibly difficult time, honestly one of the worst of my entire life. But I'm a man of faith, and I'm a man that has knowledge of my history, and I would not bring my family, our lives, or the movement through a fire like this. I just wouldn't.
That's Jussie Smollett speaking following the decision that prosecutors made to drop all the charges. Yamiche, this case has evolved in fascinating ways over the last 2 months.
It's evolved in fascinating ways. And it's also, at this point, we don't really know what happened. Jussie Smollett has been cleared of 16 felony charges. His lawyer is adamant that there was no deal reached on the prosecutor's side. They say there was a deal reached, that he forfeited $10,000 of bail money, as well as and the fact that he's going to be have to or had serve community service. And then you have the police superintendent and the mayor, very, very angry at the prosecution for what they say is reaching a deal. And then, of course, add to that the fact that President Trump is talking about this. He said that he's personally asked federal officials to look into this case, which, of course, among all the other things that the federal government could be looking into. And then last night in Michigan at his rally, he said that this whole case was a national embarrassment and that someone needs to get to the bottom of it. So it really is just, I think, fascinating. And it's in some ways really sad because we might not ever know what happened, because as far as I understand, the case is sealed and Jussie Smollett's record is going to be expunged. So we might not ever know.
Yeah, with regards to the president, he did tweet this week that the FBI and the Department of Justice will review the case. In the tweet, he also referred to it as, in his words, an embarrassment to our nation. With regards to that, A.C. Monroe tweeted, the DOJ and the FBI should investigate the Chicago Police Department, the prosecutor's office, and the mayor for corruption and burying police brutality. Forget Jussie. There are much bigger fish to fry in Chicago. Franklin from Baltimore agrees. Franklin emailed, I'm almost glad that the charges were dropped against Jussie Smollett, given the inability of Chicago to punish the other officers involved in the Laquan McDonald shooting, who filed false police reports and obstructed justice. Throwing the book at Jussie while these men walk free would not be a good look for Chicago. Swin, that was almost impossible to sever from the backdrop of this. It's just the history of prosecution and law enforcement in Chicago, especially as it relates to race.
No, absolutely. And I mean, objectively speaking, there are much bigger issues that have to do with Chicago, Illinois, that the feds could be and perhaps should be looking into that have nothing to do with an actor who stars on the TV show Empire. But the reason Trump world and the president of the United States love this story so much and will amplify it as much as they can over the coming weeks or months is because it evinces everything and every narrative that they want to push about the other side. There are a bunch of Trump-hating liberals and hoaxers and allies in the media who are willing to say that you, the average American, perhaps white even, Trump supporter, is willing to go out there and try to brutalize or lynch a gay black man because you're bigoted and you're a Trump supporter. And look, it's all falling apart. It was all a hoax. And you can use that as your political binky. You can use it as a comfort to you that they are the real bigots and hoaxers and we are the Trumpian vanguard. So they'll be playing this up and doing, we've been using this term a lot over the past hour, victory laps over this for quite some time, just because it's good PR.
And also, Susan, with regards to what happens from here, as Yamiche mentioned, Chicago's Mayor Rahm Emanuel was very upset over this decision. He held a press conference soon after the charges were dropped. Here's part of what Mayor Emanuel said.
Did this all in the name of self-promotion. And he used the laws of the hate crime legislation that all of us collectively over years have put on the books to stand up to be the values that embody what we believe in. This is a whitewash of justice. A grand jury could not have been clearer.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel speaking this week after the charges were dropped. This gets into some complex areas of law, Susan, and you know, with the political aspect of this that Swin just mentioned, with the aspect of race that some of our listeners just mentioned, I'm not sure where this leaves us, especially now that it is both legal and political.
Well, that's right. Look, I tend to see this as a classic, write it up to a chapter in the culture wars circa the mid-Trump era. In fact, the president said last night, another thing he mentioned in his rally was this might be the only thing that Mayor Rahm Emanuel and I actually agree on, is that justice was not done in this case. But again, what does it tell you? It tells you you have a president who is essentially also our pundit in chief. He's sitting there watching TV. He sees this case talked about incessantly on Fox. He sees people tweeting about it, obsessing over it. He sees an opportunity to score a point in the ongoing politicized culture and race wars in our country. When people talk about opting out of social media, I got to tell you, this is one of the stories they're talking about. I wish we weren't talking about it.
I want to talk about the NCAA in just a moment, since the Sweet 16 has wrapped up. But I do want to go back to a few comments on Robert Mueller, since we have a little bit of time. Savvy Troll writes, all we can conclude is that there was not enough evidence to bring charges with a sufficient confidence of obtaining a conviction, not that there was no evidence. Victor tweeted, Mueller and Barr go back 30 years. If Barr made false claims about Mueller's 2-year investigation, wouldn't Mueller respond? Swin, that might be possible, because there are some who say that they would like Robert Mueller to testify in public.
No, absolutely. I think at the very least, Democratic lawmakers in Capitol Hill are going to be pushing hard for figures like Barr and Mueller to come and testify. Because, I mean, it's objectively true that there are a lot of questions at this point. They're completely unanswered. So in the interest for the American people, not just partisan politics, let's get as many of those answers broken into the public sphere as much as we can.
But Susan, then that becomes political as well, because you'll have Republicans on the other side of the aisle saying they won't let this go. It's in the Attorney General's discretion to receive the report, interpret it as he sees fit, release what he sees fit. That is his job, duly confirmed by the Senate. Let this go. And in technical terms, they're right. That is the Attorney General's purview.
Well, except I disagree. I believe that it is inherently political. We are not talking about a standard case. We're talking about an investigation of the President of the United States, which is inherently political. That is the only realm through which there is any possible accountability in our system, and it lies with Congress, with an independent branch of government. So, of course, that's political. Any question of wrongdoing by the President of the United States in his official capacity and while he serves in office is political. So it's not going to go away, regardless of the narrower question of what exactly is in this report. And for that reason, I believe that ultimately we will probably see Robert Mueller under oath testifying. And he may well believe that is the only appropriate forum for him, in fact, to tell us whether his report has been accurately characterized or not. This is not a guy, from based on whatever we know about him and his long career in public service, who's going to be giving exclusive interviews to TV news programs. He's not going to be tweeting out, weird pictures of himself a la James Comey, pondering the universe in the wake of his government service being completed. He is much more likely to believe that it would be his duty and his obligation to testify before an independent branch of the government than to do any of the other things that we've seen so many figures do in this most unusual political era.
Although, go ahead, Yamiche, briefly.
I would also just say that this is going to, because of the political atmosphere that Susan is really describing, the nuance of a report is going to be so hard to understand. If there is nuance in this report, in this political atmosphere, I just think it might be lost.
One last story. We'll step away from politics to talk college basketball, especially if you feel like you're just crossing your fingers in life, hoping you make the right choices. Take heart. That's how many people build their brackets. And among those people is a man from Columbus, Ohio, whose bracket this year was nearly perfect. The bracket Greg Nigel registered on NCAA.com correctly predicted every game leading up to the Sweet 16. The odds of that are less than 1 in 281 trillion. But Nigel says he's no guru.
I watch a lot of Big Ten games, so I know those teams pretty well. But, I mean, obviously I watch, like, North Carolina and Duke, and I've seen Virginia play. But a lot of the other teams, you know, I've never seen them play this year. So it's really listening to people on the news, you know, bracketology, reading some stuff, and honestly just luck or going with what school I like better.
So while other college basketball fans were racking their brains, he nailed it by picking schools he liked and reading some stuff. Unfortunately, last night, his bracket broke. Nigel failed to predict Purdue beating Tennessee or Texas Tech beating Michigan, but his pick for the championship, Gonzaga, did win last night. The odds of him getting all 63 games in the bracket right would have been less than 1 in 9 quintillion. That's 1 in 9 billion billion. We were lucky to have a great panel, including Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Yamiche, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks.
Aswin Subsang, who covers the White House for the Daily Beast. Thank you, Swin.
Anytime.
And Susan Glasser, staff writer for The New Yorker and a global affairs analyst for CNN. Thanks, Susan.
Great to be here.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LegalZoom. Business owners can count on LegalZoom for legal advice and no surprises. Over 2 million business owners have trusted LegalZoom for LLCs, S-Corps, and DBAs. They've built a network of independent attorneys available in all 50 states, and LegalZoom provides complete transparency with upfront pricing and customer reviews to bring you peace of mind. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
What does what you eat or don't eat say about who you are and where you fit in?
It's the memories and the feelings of nostalgia that is what connects you to your family. It's not chicken or beef or pork.
This is Gene Demby of NPR's Code Switch. This week on the menu, food and family.
This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. This was supposed to be a very big day in Britain. 2 years ago, Prime Minister Theresa May promised the UK that it would leave the European Union by today.
Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
Well, today's the day, and the Brits are still in the EU. That's because lawmakers have not agreed on a Brexit plan, despite the Prime Minister literally offering to quit her job if they voted her way. Today, British lawmakers rejected her plan again. We'll get into all of that and much more on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us to make sense of this week's international stories is Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst and the director of the International Security Program at New America. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
Indira Lakshmanan is executive editor of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting and a columnist at the Boston Globe. Hi, Indira.
Hi there.
And Ravi Agrawal is the managing editor of Foreign Policy. Ravi, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Let's begin with Brexit. Had things gone to plan, today would have been the day that saw the UK leave the European Union. But that is not how it panned out. All attempts for an orderly departure have failed, including today's vote, which throws Brexit into even more doubt. To give you some idea about how bad things have gotten, people in Boston, Lincolnshire, which is the most pro-Brexit city in England, spoke this week to Marketplace's Kai Rizdal.
What do you do for a living?
Stonemason.
Stonemason. How's business? I mean, you're working on a building now. Now, come on. We're trying to do a thing here. So why do you want to remain?
I think it'd be better for the economy. I think it'd be better for everybody.
How long have you been here, Rachel?
About 22 years. Yeah.
Do you like it?
No.
How come? What's going on?
Immigration. My little girl, I've got a little girl at nursery. I've got a girl at primary school. The little girl at primary school, 80% of her class is foreigners.
That's Marketplace's Kai Rizdal speaking to people in Boston, Lincolnshire, which is the most pro-Brexit city in England. Indira Lakshmanan, let me start with you. You just got back from the UK. What's it like right now?
Well, first of all, I can say it's a complete obsession. People have blinders on. It was really interesting to be there during all of this Mueller report being finished because nobody had a single question for me about Trump or Mueller or the Russia investigation.
Wow.
They were just really, you know, mono-focused on Brexit because, of course, it's been gripping this country for 2 years now, more than 2 years, two and a half. And, you know, it's really gotten to the point now where, as you were saying, the Parliament has already rejected, prior to today, two of Theresa May's Brexit deals, or the deal twice. And the EU had finally agreed to give her an extension from today, which was the original Brexit deadline, to April. Well, basically, it was going to be till the 22nd of May if she was able to pass today's deal, because she wasn't. Actually, ironically, the Brexit deadline has now jumped forward to 2 weeks from now, to the 12th of April. The whole situation is pretty shambolic. I mean, you have on the side, I would say, a lot of this problem certainly was self-inflicted by Britons, by those pro-Brexiteers who gave false information about the effect it was going to have on the economy, gave, you know, there was a lot of social media stuff that was wrong. But Theresa May shot herself in the foot by calling for early elections that she did not need to do. She had a majority. She thought she was going to get a bigger majority. And in fact, she lost seats and was forced to form this coalition with this hardline DUP, which is the Northern Ireland Unionist Party. And what that has done is they've been so hardline that they have prevented her. The extremes have prevented her from getting any deal. I mean, I think the bottom line here is there is literally no deal right now that could win a majority in Parliament. No deal.
With regards to that, Ravi, first of all, you had the vote total just a second ago.
I did.
How bad was it?
344 to 286.
So not a blowout, but certainly not a
victory. It's still quite bad, but nowhere near as bad as the previous two votes, which were both historic.
Now, there was another day earlier on where I think Parliament voted on, what was it, 8 different plans? And none of them passed? So what's the end game now? I mean, the March 29th deadline is now April. Does anyone have a clue about what happens next?
Well, it's unclear. What we do know is that Brexit Day will come and go, which is where we're at right now. The next big day is going to be April the 12th. But I think before that, what we're going to see is that Donald Tusk, the European Council president, has already said that he wants to host a European Council meeting on April the 10th. And I guess in the days preceding that, the UK is going to have to try and figure out what it can possibly do to avoid what they're calling a hard Brexit or no deal Brexit. And that may involve kicking the can way down the road. And so asking for another extension, but a much longer extension to try and maybe forge together some kind of a deal. The third possibility to all of this is perhaps another referendum. And of course, there are many in Parliament who think that that would be quite drastic and it would hurt them. But at some stage, I think that will end up becoming an option that more people will look towards because they've lost the confidence of the people.
So just before I come to Peter, Ravi, it seems like the European Council and the European Union are trying to be merciful with Britain as much as they can to prevent the UK from just ripping itself away from the EU without resolving things like trade and borders, especially between Ireland and Northern Ireland, immigration issues. They're trying to be as patient as they can, but their patience has limits.
Right, of course. And they're extremely frustrated about the way this has played out over the last 2.5 years. And I mean, a no-deal Brexit is good for nobody. I mean, that will mean immense pain for businesses across the continent and in the UK, of course. It will mean the problem, the sort of the backstop problem between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland and so many other problems. And so that's in no one's interest. But at the same time, the EU has to figure out how it can sort of at least keep Theresa May or whoever is in power at that stage to their word to figure out a plan.
Peter Bergen, last week we saw about 1 million people protest Brexit in London. I understand you went to school not far from Boston, where we heard that those clips from Kaya Rizdal. Talk about just the cultural spectrum of views on whether to stay in the EU. Why is that spectrum so broad?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in England. I'm an American citizen, but my parents moved there when I was a kid. And, you know, I mean, let's start with the fact that the EU is basically a German and a French institution. And there is no group of people that the English dislike more than the French and the Germans. I mean, they had a 100 years war with the French starting in 1337. They fought a lot of other wars since. They fought two very, very nasty wars with the Germans. So there's this kind of like, I think there is a certain kind of little Englander kind of approach to this that explains a lot of this. Because from an economic point of view, none of this makes any sense. The way I look at it is, if you look at the dollar the day the Brexit vote happened, you could buy, £1 could buy $1.5 the day the Brexit vote. Today, £1 buys $1.3. So the markets are speaking. They're basically, this thing makes no sense. And as Ravi has pointed out, the uncertainty around this, if we go to a no deal kind of hard exit, which is not impossible and could happen 2 weeks from now, what does that mean for the British economy? I mean, I think it will be disastrous and not in the interests of the American people. But people don't vote their economic interests sometimes. They vote their emotions. And there was a lot of emotion around this to do with the nature of British identity. And you heard that woman in the piece in from Boston Lincolnshire talking about all these immigrants. You know, that there is a great anti-immigrant sentiment, not only in Britain, but also around Europe and indeed in the West in general.
Now, Theresa May said she would resign as Prime Minister if Parliament somehow passed a deal that they have already rejected twice. I wonder, Indira, how her resignation might help or hurt things. And before you answer, here is a clip of Jens Geier, who is a German member of the European Parliament. Here's how he decided to answer this exact same question this week.
Frankly, I couldn't care less.
Why not?
Well, it is the British people who have to make up their mind, and I'm really tired of thinking about what should help and what not.
Sorry. You're bored of Brexit.
Sorry?
You're bored of Brexit.
Bored to death.
Jens Geier, who's a German member of the European Parliament, bored to death with the Brits, Indira.
All right.
And I can't really blame him, because this has kind of been like a slow-motion car crash,
yes,
where the cars haven't hit each other yet, and they've been driving toward each other for months.
Yeah, well, I sort of think of it in a different way, as a multi-car pileup. I think that crash has already happened, and it's caused a mess. You talked about kicking the can down the road. I think you're just kicking the can into the crash site.
Jim asks, if a hard exit occurs, what specifically will happen that's harmful to the UK's economy? Won't all sides basically agree to operating status quo for a limited time while actual agreements finally get hammered out? Peter?
I mean, I think it's not clear. But, I mean, ultimately, if Britain leaves essentially the common market, I mean, that has a huge effect on everything it trades with the EU. I mean, right, why do people join the EU? They join the EU so they're in a zone where there are no tariffs, essentially. You know, presumably many of those will go away. And the other point is that the city of London is kind of the heart of so much of drives the British economy. And companies are leaving because they don't want to do business in this either this uncertainty or in this new regulatory framework that isn't clear. So cities like Amsterdam may become more important financial centers in Europe, and companies, you know, London will not be what it has been, which is the center of the financial world along with New York. And so these are the kinds of things that could happen as a hard deal approaches.
Sandby writes, May, Theresa May, is so weak she has spent her entire premiership kowtowing to the most extreme elements in her own party and her coalition partners. She is not a leader. Indira, I see you nodding to that.
Yeah, I think the problem here is that, as I said earlier, she actually did not support Brexit. But when she was thrust into the prime ministership by the resignation of David Cameron, who, by the way, I think is going to have a lot to answer in the history books to having, you know, declared this referendum again somewhat recklessly without planning ahead of time of, is this going to be binding? What does it mean? Because actually a referendum is not binding. But when it didn't go the way that he expected and assumed it would go, and he had to resign and she was put into place, she has spent the last 2.5 years trying to make possible a deal that she didn't even support in the first place. And perhaps she could have gotten it done if she had from the very beginning tried to build coalitions within Parliament. I think she could have made a sort of compromise deal that would have worked. But instead, she pandered to the far extreme right of her party from the very beginning. That's always a mistake. You know, we've at least in British politics, it's not been terribly successful.
Well, and an extreme right, I should say, Indira, I'm sorry to interrupt, but also an extreme right whose primary firebrand, Nigel Farage, is no longer on the political scene. He got what he wanted as the head of the UK Independence Party, which pushed hard for Brexit. They won. And he kind of washed his hands and said thank you and good night.
Right. But her main obstacle now, although he voted for the deal today for the first time, is Jacob Rees-Mogg, who is this far-right Tory who runs this European research group faction. And they're very anti-Brexit. But interestingly enough, that faction voted for her deal today because they're starting to get panicked that if this doesn't get approved, that there won't be a Brexit, that there will be this long, long extension and potentially a new referendum. And don't forget, Theresa May's offer to resign was contingent upon her getting the deal through this third time. Today, she did not get that deal through, so I would assume that the resignation offer no longer stands. And if a referendum, which the 1 to 2 million people who demonstrated in London on Saturday were calling for, if a new referendum happens, even if every single person voted again today the way they voted 2.5 years ago, there have been enough deaths in the highest age demographic who are most pro-Brexit, enough new voters in the lowest age demographic who are anti-Brexit, and I think a lot of millennials who just sat it out might actually vote. So I think that the answer to the referendum might actually be quite different.
Ravi, briefly, one more comment before we keep going. Aaron writes, the British Parliament should bite the bullet and say they aren't leaving the EU. They obviously cannot figure out a way to leave that they all can agree on. What a mess. That may or may not be possible. I mean, they invoked Article 50 of the EU Charter, which says we're leaving. And it's been said that Brexit means Brexit. Theresa May has said it. The EU has said it. So they might not be able to do a do-over.
Yeah, the time has passed now for that, given how many times they've said they want to follow the will of the people and how much importance they've placed in the result of this referendum. I think the only way for them to actually take that path would be to put it to the people once more. And the problem with that, let's not forget, is that when you have a parliamentary democracy, the last thing you want to do is to have a referendum, because that is exactly what parliamentary democracies do not do. You elect parliamentarians to make decisions on your behalf. So once you open that door, it's a slippery slope. And once you have one referendum, to have a second and then a third, it's like rolling the dice once and not liking the result and wanting to roll it two more times. So this is a complete mess. There is no clean or clear solution from here. And, you know, Theresa May, even though she said that she would resign if the vote passed, I think she may not have a choice either way, because she looks really bad. And now that she signaled she would be willing to go, she is, in effect, what they call a lame duck.
Yeah, she was already in kind of a tenuous political position. And then after that referendum, or after the no confidence vote, she's in an even more tenuous place. So we will keep an eye on Brexit. Place your bets as to where that's going to end up. Let's talk about Israel, Peter, because on Monday, President Trump signed a declaration officially recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. We'll get to the politics of that in a second, but just explain for us, Peter, strategically why the Golan Heights is important to the U.S. and to Israel.
Well, it's very important to Israel. They took it during the 1967 war, and, you know, as the name implies, it's a height which basically commands the approaches from Syria. And Israel obviously has had wars with its Arab neighbors, and this allows it some strategic advantage. I mean, the problem here is that, of course, in international law, if you seize something by force, it's not yours. And so, you know, there was no demand signal really for the for this to happen, except from, you know, Netanyahu, who's in an election race, which is I think it's April 9th is the date of the election. And obviously, this is a political gift to him. One of the things that I've been struck by is, you know, Donald Trump wrote the art of the deal, but this is the art of the giveaway, because two times the United States has given something to the Netanyahu government, which they really want, without seeking anything in return. I mean, when we moved our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and you can argue the pros and cons of that, we didn't seek anything from the Netanyahu government in terms of, you know, slowing the settlers' movement down or some kind of quid pro quo. And so if we just seem to be giving the Likud government what they want at any given moment.
Can we follow that line about Benjamin Netanyahu a little further, Indira, because he was scheduled to speak this week at the annual conference of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, a very strong pro-Israel political affairs committee, or a strong Israel PAC. But he canceled his appearance because of turmoil in Israel. He did deliver a live video address. Technical issues made it only partially audible. But what did he manage to get across to AIPAC? And why was he speaking to AIPAC now?
I mean, what he got ahead, I mean, I think part of the reason he was speaking to AIPAC was to try to bolster his leadership right ahead of this election that Peter mentioned. Remember, he is embroiled in this corruption scandal in Israel. He's potentially facing indictments, so he could potentially be in a weak position. However, a poll was just done this week in Israel, and among every group of Israelis, so I'm talking about Israeli, Jewish Israelis, Arab Israelis, every group, whether they were left, right, or center, said that Trump's declaration that Israel really is recognized as having the Golan Heights was going to help Netanyahu. So whether people liked him or didn't like him, they all said this is going to help him in the election. As far as talking at AIPAC, I mean, I think AIPAC has been a huge supporter of the Likud party and of Netanyahu. It would be an unnecessary snub for him not to talk via video conference. He's got a captive audience of people who are with him. And it's also a thank you to the Trump administration for recognizing Jerusalem as the capital, for recognizing the Golan Heights. And we haven't talked about this, but the fact that Israel, you know, occupied the Golan Heights 50 years ago, moved to annex it in 1981. It was not recognized by the international community. Now this potentially sets a precedent of the United States recognizing and allowing people to annex land and saying, yes, it's yours. So the next question that comes to me is, first, does this mean that Netanyahu can say, well, we've annexed the West Bank and now that's ours? We don't have to, you know, recognize it's occupied territory, it's ours. Can Vladimir Putin say, well, we've annexed Crimea.
I was just going to mention Crimea.
So now that's ours. You know, is this going to be the Trump administration policy to just say, if we like you, then when you annex land, yes, it's yours?
Yeah, Ravi, I wanted to ask you about just the strategic importance on the ground. Some of our listeners have commented on that. Michael emailed, it's important to remember that the Golan Heights was territory captured by the Israelis during the Six-Day War. It was territory that was won after Syria continued to shell Israeli villages from the heights and refused to honor a UN-called-for ceasefire that Israel, Egypt, and Jordan had agreed to. The strategic importance of the Golan Heights now is greater than ever, given the degradation of Syrian airborne forces. Ravi, what's your sense of the strategic importance of the Golan Heights now?
Well, it's very important, and especially given what's going on in Syria right now, it only becomes more important. But the larger strategic problem is that once you get in the business of approving other countries' sort of territorial takeovers, where does it stop? Because you set a precedent for A, being able to do that, B, for other countries to know then that this is part of your arsenal and they can jockey for you being able to sort of approve takeovers of that sort, be it Crimea, be it, say, a portion of Kashmir. And that's a terrible precedent to set in international relations. But lastly, and this is perhaps the most troubling aspect of this, is that it then allows other countries to play one side against the other within the United States. So you can play Dems against Republicans. And one of the things that came out of Netanyahu's speech, the video conference speech that you mentioned, is that it was very clear how he was siding with Republicans over Democrats. And again, I mean, once you begin to allow other leaders from around the world to pick between two sides in the United States, that's really shaky territory to be entering.
Let's talk about Syria. On Saturday, the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces confirmed that ISIS has lost the last of its territory in Syria. The fall of the Syrian town of Bahuz marked the end of the caliphate that had been declared back in 2014. President Trump was quick to hand out maps to reporters to mark the occasion. Peter Bergen, there was kind of a before map and an after map that they handed out. But what's really going on the ground? I mean, is it safe to say that ISIS has been defeated?
Well, I mean, let's not underestimate. This is important. The geographical defeat of the ISIS so-called caliphate is very important because, you know, their claim to fame is they control territory the size of Portugal and population larger than that of Bulgaria at the height of their power in early 2015. And that produced 40,000 people from around the world who went to fight with them, including 7,000 from the West, including a small number of Americans, but lots of Europeans and others from around the Arab world. So, you know, now they don't have that territory. No one wants to join the losing team. That foreign fighter flow, which was one point $1,500 a month, has gone down to zero. So that is a big deal. But the ideology lives on, and the circumstances that produced ISIS live on, which are basically, you know, increasing sectarianism in the region, which has destroyed Syria and Iraq to some degree, and now Yemen, and is popping up in Afghanistan, the collapse of the failing and failed governments in the region, the kind of failing economies, the demographic explosion, even climate change. All of this is a very toxic mix, some of which, you know, leads to the kind of conditions that groups like ISIS thrive on. So we're going to see a son of ISIS and a grandson of ISIS. And President Trump has to be careful that he doesn't take the same victory lap that, in a way, President Obama did back in January of 2014, when he said to David Remnick of The New Yorker that the precursor group of ISIS was sort of a JV team. And, you know, that was always something that people sort of said, well, they kind of missed it. And you know, the point is, yes, this is important, but don't take a huge victory lap, because other groups basically can kind of thrive on some of the same chaotic conditions that ISIS did.
Indira, I totally take Peter's point in terms of the potential for something else to succeed ISIS. Very possible, especially because of all the unrest in these parts of the world. I mean, Iraq announced that it had claimed all of ISIS's territory within its borders in 2017, but the attacks continued. Still, the loss of territory does mean something. I mean, it's a sign of a very dramatic shift in ISIS that forces it to be more ideological, and it kind of robs it of its ability to say, okay, we're going to build a caliphate here. This is where we are.
Well, what it does is it shifts them from being actual administrators of territory who were able to extort taxes, seize banks, run oil wells. I mean, they had at one point, you know, $2 billion coming in from the Bank of Mosul, essentially unlimited resources from oil wells in Iraq and Syria that they controlled. So they don't get to control the territory anymore, but they're still really strong and significant insurgents. And the Pulitzer Center has supported several projects of reporters going to Iraq and Syria lately, including one that I recommend everyone to read by Ben Taub for The New Yorker. We supported his project where he went and won the George Polk Award for a story in December showing that essentially the Iraqi government post-ISIS is engaging in a humongous campaign of retribution against Sunni Muslims that is causing so much anger and feeling of bitterness that there are actually people who are missing ISIS. So, you know, there's the whole cycle of events that could allow ISIS to come back. Kim Dozier also reported for us and for the Daily Beast about how ISIS still rules the night, even though they're technically their land is gone. Of course, it's significant that Baghouz in eastern Syria, which was the first place taken by ISIS, is now the last place to be liberated. Of course, I'm not diminishing that, but the fight is ongoing, and it will basically turn into a fight against insurgents. And let's not forget, as Peter, you know, suggested, it was al-Qaeda in Iraq that became ISIS, and there will be a grandson. There will be ISIS will either stay ISIS as insurgents, or there'll be some other group that it morphs into. So the threat has not gone away, and the U.S. military is keeping 1,000 troops in Syria.
I also, Ravi, would love to get your sense in terms of what happens to the people who are left behind in the fight against ISIS in this territory. The forces that the United States backed, particularly Kurdish forces, they are now kind of stuck in that part of the world. So I'd love to get your sense of that. And we continue with the Friday News Roundup with Ravi Agrawal of Foreign Policy, Indira Lakshmanan of the Pulitzer Center and the Boston Globe, and Peter Bergen of CNN and New America. Still have some stories out of Africa to talk about, including a natural disaster, a cyclone that struck, weeks of youth-led protests in Algeria, and the Indians shooting down a satellite missile. We'll get to all of those stories in a moment. Stay close.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus. They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. One of the world's top mixed martial artists is retiring from the sport under some controversial circumstances. This week, Conor McGregor tweeted that he has left the sport. He gained fame as one of the most successful and highly paid fighters in the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Meanwhile, McGregor is being investigated in Ireland after a woman accused him of sexual assault. He maintains that he is not retiring because of the investigation. Two stories out of the Vatican this week. The all-female board of the Vatican's women's magazine has resigned en masse, citing a culture of distrust and retaliation for their reporting on sexual abuse. The Women Church World is a monthly supplement to the official Vatican Daily magazine. Last month, it created an uproar after publishing a piece on the sexual abuse of nuns by clergy. Meanwhile, Pope Francis has issued a new law for reporting sex abuse by priests. The new rule requires clergy to immediately report abuse claims to the authorities. Failing to do so could lead to a fine or jail time. For now, this rule only applies to Vatican City. We're discussing the week's top stories from around the world with Ravi Agrawal, Indira Lakshmanan, and Peter Bergen. Ravi, before we move on from Syria, what about the fighters who are left behind, who assisted with the fight against ISIS? They have fights of their own that they now have to deal with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they'll need to be reintegrated in some form into the larger society. And I mean, this is the big problem with territory that ISIS gives up, and why we mustn't celebrate it necessarily the way some have, because it's really hard to hold on to territory. And in a sense, if you look at how not only ISIS, but other terror groups have functioned in the past, they function more as ideologies. And so the battle is not just a battle for territory. In fact, that's the least important one, I think. I think the more important one is the battle for hearts and minds, and the battle for, you know, how seductive that ideology is, not only in the place that you're seeing it play out, but globally. And so to that end, I think reintegrating former fighters in some way that's productive is very important. And then also to be very wary of how ISIS ideology or anything like that, as Peter put it, you know, the son or the grandson, it's very important to keep an eye out for that globally.
Two stories out of Africa we'd like to talk about briefly. It's been 2 weeks since Cyclone Idai killed hundreds in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. Now the first cases of cholera have been reported in the Mozambique city of Beira. The World Health Organization is expected to send 900,000 doses of cholera vaccines to the region this week. And it says that the spread of waterborne diseases would mark a second disaster. Indira, this is the kind of thing that more developing parts of the world are having to deal with, kind of the compound effects of both climate change and then everything that comes with it.
Absolutely. I mean, climate change is affecting all coastal areas in the world and polar areas, but it's more heavily impacting those such areas in the developing world because they have fewer resources, older infrastructure, more crowded living conditions, you know, poorer sewage systems, all sorts of things that make them much more vulnerable. And as you said, Cyclone Idai, you know, hit Mozambique and Zimbabwe and Malawi. And not only did it kill hundreds of people, but it displaced hundreds of thousands of people and flooded an area of 3,000 square kilometers. So, you know, in the end, this tropical storm has affected 2 million people. As you said, the first cases of cholera are complicating everything. But I think let's look at it in terms of the larger picture, which is that extreme weather of all forms, which is caused by climate change, has affected almost 62 million people last year, according to the World Meteorological Organization. And this is one example. But, you know, all the effects that we have from climate change are just getting worse and worse. We see in Bangladesh, the Maldives, certain countries that are meant to be the first to go underwater. And you're already seeing climate migrations, people escaping coastal areas and losing their livelihoods.
The other story out of Africa we wanted to note was weeks of youth-led protests in Algiers, the capital of Algeria. Yesterday, hundreds of demonstrators took to the streets again, calling for Algeria's president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, to resign. On Tuesday, Algeria's army chief of staff asked that the Constitutional Council there rule on whether the ailing president is fit for office. But the opposition rejected that proposal. Protesters want an all-new political system, and they want President Bouteflika to step down immediately. Peter Bergen, what's happening here? These protests have been going on for weeks. Algeria, I don't think, is usually on Americans' radar, but what's happening here?
Well, you know, Algeria was somewhat immune from the currents of the Arab Spring. So it's interesting to see these kind of Arab Springy-like protests. And the reasons are very simple. Bouteflika is trying to run for his fifth term. He's 82. TV pictures of him show him to be kind of confined to a wheelchair, it looks like, and very out of it. And he's run this place as sort of an authoritarian, sort of electoral dictatorship, as it were. And people are sick of it. The problem is Algeria went through a very nasty civil war in the mid-90s, where 200,000 people were killed. And so I think one of the reasons that Algerians didn't go down the route of the Arab Spring as they saw what was happening in neighboring countries, had already gone through their own civil war and were reluctant to kind of create the conditions that might precipitate another civil war. But here we are again. And Bouteflika, you know, I mean, he's not an impressive leader at this point. I'm not sure he can even speak. The TV pictures I've seen of him suggest that he's completely out of it.
Let me get to a story out of India this week. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi said that India had shot down a satellite with a missile. The advanced technology that's required to do this would vault India into an elite group of nations. It's been seen as a shift in the balance of power in a region that can be unstable in that regard, and the Pentagon confirmed this test. Ravi, before we talk about the security impact of this, there's also a political implication for Narendra Modi because there are elections coming up.
That's right. And the elections start in about 3 weeks' time. These are elections they last for about 5 weeks. I mean, if you think the American election season is long and expensive, think about India, the second most expensive elections in the world, the most number of people voting in history, 900 million people. So it's a very big election. And it's sort of a referendum on Narendra Modi as such, because he's been in power for 5 years. And he came to power promising a whole swath of things that would improve infrastructure in India, creating jobs for millions of Indians, putting a smartphone in every Indian's hand. He had all these promises, and many would say he hasn't come good on all of those promises. So in the last couple of months, we've seen some very interesting developments on that front. One was India and Pakistan nearing the brink of war. And right around about that time, the Indian media was whipping up a lot of sort of jingoism and public sentiment that was both anti-Pakistan but pro the government of the time, which was Modi's government, which then led many to think that, you know, maybe Modi has a good chance of being reelected because of, you know, pro-government sentiment at a time of crisis. And so there are critics who say that the timing of this particular announcement, why announce that you've got this big new missile that can shoot down satellites in space today? Why this week? Why not wait for a few more weeks? And so if that is the case, I mean, all signs point to the fact that young Indians like this kind of stuff. They like to appear to be strong. They like India to be seen as muscular, to be competing not just with Pakistan, but with China. Which is one of the other countries that has this kind of technology. So on the one hand, I mean, this is significant in that, similar to having nuclear weapons, this elevates India into a very elite club of countries that have space capabilities. But the timing is a bit suspect. And I do think it will have an impact on the elections.
We've been getting a lot of great questions from several of you about some stories that we've talked about in the roundup. I want to back up to a few of them. But first, Indira, I wanted to get your reaction to something that Facebook announced this week. Facebook announced that it will ban white nationalist and white separatist rhetoric from its platform. Now, the social network had already banned white supremacist rhetoric. And historians and advocates say there's not really an ostensible difference between white nationalist, white separatist, white supremacist, at least not in terms of how the rubber meets the road. But this news comes 2 weeks after a series of shootings at mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand. Indira, it's worth noting that most Facebook users are not in the U.S., most of them around the world. The platform has 2 billion monthly active users. Presumably each user is an individual person, but that's debatable. This is a big step for Facebook to say that it's going to ban an entire ideology worldwide.
Yeah. And what's interesting about it is that Facebook had in the past, as you said, made this distinction between white nationalism and white supremacy. And they've now said, and I think this is a very important step, that you can't make a distinction anymore, that white nationalism encourages white supremacy and encourages the violence associated with it. And I think it's a great step in terms of its ability, it wants to improve its ability to identify and block material from terrorist groups of all sorts. And white supremacy, of course, is a form of terrorism. And as I think many listeners might not know, in fact, in the United States, there have been more deaths and more attacks at the hands of white supremacists post 9/11 than at the hands of, Muslim radical extremists. I think what's interesting is Facebook acknowledged that, you know, this horrible attack at the two mosques that was live streamed on Facebook Live by the attacker had been viewed 4,000 times. So the murder of 50 people had been viewed 4,000 times before the company took it down. And they said that they blocked 1.2 million copies at the point of upload and deleted another 300,000. So there was plenty of appetite for people who, for whatever reason, get their jollies or inspiration out of watching people be murdered. And I think it is an important step that, you know, the biggest social media platform would take a step to say, no, we don't condone this.
But Peter Bergen, I also wonder about the proliferation of these kind of ideologies online. It seems like in some ways they've kind of fled Facebook for darker, quieter corners of the web.
Yeah, I mean, there's 8chan and other kind of, I haven't really explored 8chan personally, but I mean, they're, you know, so if you're an extremist, whether you're ISIS or a neo-Nazi, you do have a bit of a dilemma. The darker the web, the less accessible it is. So, I mean, what you really want to do is be out in the open. And if you want to crowdsource jihad, it's Twitter and Facebook. If you want to be very, very careful, you're on Telegram in peer-to-peer kind of encrypted communications, but that's not broadcasting the message. So I think it's a dilemma for these extremist groups that they really want to spread. They want to be on these traditional platforms. But I do think it's a slippery slope on this question of white nationalism. I mean, there are people in this country who've been motivated by black nationalist ideas, who've gone out and killed people. Is the next step to say, well, black nationalist ideology is also something we're going to ban? Or choose your kind of more extremist Facebook, you know, I mean, none of these things are easy.
Let me get back to a few of your comments on some of the stories we've discussed before we wrap up. With regards to Brexit, Martin in Oak Ridge, Tennessee writes, if you haven't already done so, you owe it to yourself to watch the movie Brexit starring Benedict Cumberbatch. It chillingly outlines how a campaign can use social media to target voters and amplify latent grievances to get people to vote against their interests. This has obvious implications for our own electoral system. With regard to the fight against ISIS, Politics Watcher writes, Trump has defeated ISIS to the same degree that Bush defeated Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Hint for Republicans, not defeated. Ravi, is that fair?
I think it's fair enough to say that.
With regard to the Golan Heights, John had a little bit of a smart alecky comment. John tweeted that he's personally hoping that Canada annexes Michigan if land grabs are okay now. We'd like Michigan. Stop picking on me.
You might have seen that Iran was so mad about Trump recognizing the Golan Heights, which, by the way, Syria has not threatened Israel from the Golan Heights for many years now. It sort of left it as, okay, you control that. So it's been a sort of de facto belonging to Israel. Anyway, Iran was so mad they declared, well, you know, why don't you have Israel annex South Carolina instead? So there are a lot of people making that joke from all corners.
That would be interesting to see, quite frankly. I just want to know how they'd try to pull it off. Sticking with the Golan Heights, Michael emailed, are we really saying that the actions of Israel are the same as Russia in Crimea? I think you can both support a rare U.S. ally in the Levant and condemn the actions of an adversary and see a legitimate difference between the two. Peter, what do you think?
Well, I mean, the 67 war was a war of aggression against Israel by its neighbors. So it's a little bit of a different, I mean, and Israel. But nonetheless, the fact is that, you know, we think we are, or we'd like to be, bound by international law. And what's puzzling about this is there was really no reason to do this, as Indira sort of suggested. I mean, there's been a kind of acceptance in the region of the de facto situation. But now there's this de jure, claim. By the way, does the U.S. claim to say, hey, we recognize this, have any meaning in international law. I'm not a lawyer, but I very much doubt it. I just think it's just a kind of like a little gift we gave Netanyahu for no reason other than it was useful for him politically. And that's it. It doesn't really – I don't – interestingly, maybe arguing against everything we've just—I mean, it probably makes no difference anyway. And in
but
fact, it turns out
in the U.S.
politically,
and
yes,
yeah. But interestingly, it's been greeted with kind of a big shrug in the Arab world. There hasn't been like big protests or but yes, useful for Netanyahu.
I guess the issue mostly is the principle of the thing is if you kind of allow it, that it leads to this potentially slippery
slope.
And the
UN and the European Union both rejected Trump's recognition of Israeli sovereignty. So, you know, nobody except Israel has agreed with the U.S. on this. So
one more comment on Brexit. Peter writes, only 17.4 million people voted for Brexit. That was 52% of those who voted. But it was only 37% of the total electorate of Great Britain. With that small a yes vote, the Brexit process should have never gone forward. One last story pursuant to what happened in Christchurch 2 weeks ago, especially for those of us who think that we can send out a tweet with a hashtag and we're real activists. You need to meet a guy named John Sotto, a World War II veteran, 95 years old. He took 4 buses to attend an anti-racism rally in New Zealand after that shooting. And this week he talked to Radio New Zealand about it.
That tragedy in Christchurch, look what it brought out in the people. It shows the best of humanity. And it reminds people we're all human and we all are part of each other. I thought it was so sad, but you can feel the suffering of other people.
John Sotto speaking to Radio New Zealand, and he says he did not have to take the bus home. The police gave him a ride. We head into the weekend with some music by Lorde, because this week the Grammy winner from New Zealand announced that she will perform at a benefit concert to raise money for those who were affected by the shooting. It takes place April 17th at Christchurch Stadium in New Zealand. And with that, we thank Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst and director of the International Security Program at New America. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Indira Lakshmanan, executive editor of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting and a columnist at the Boston Globe. Thanks, Indira.
Thanks, Joshua.
And Ravi Agrawal, the managing editor of Foreign Policy. Ravi, it's a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
1A's senior team includes Lindsay Foster-Thomas, Danielle Knight, and Denise Couture. This episode was edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about them and the rest of our team online at the1a.org/staff. And again, please, please, please remember to fill out that short podcast survey. It's online at npr.org/podcast survey, all one word. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.